Hey everybody, it's Tom, and coming to you this week with the illustrious WD James. You guys may have encountered WD James. He's acquired a minor celebrity because he was featured on Dr. Sam Bailey's channel. She read an essay of his, The Mortal God Drops Its Mask. Which essay is featured both on this fine little by this I shouldn't say little, it's the Winter Oak, doing a lot of very interesting work there. And in addition to Winter Oak, you can find it on Substack under, I think, your Substack, which is Philosopher's Holler, right?
That's right.
Philosopher's Holler. And I go, link that stuff in the notes, right? But the theme of that essay, and I encountered WD initially through Dr. Bailey as well, is it's sort of highlighting of the limitations of modernity, which then segues into a series. I think they deserve a more explicitly political focus in that initial essay, but it segues into the series, which is about maybe 4 out of 10 deep in terms of its publication, but an extended series on the emergence of modernity, and more specifically, and I'm going to stop talking in a second because I know I can be a chatty Cathy. An essay not just about modernity, but about a latent tradition of anti-modernity or anti-egalitarian anti-modernity, because a concern here is that people who assume a stance critical of modernity are oftentimes sort of pigeonholed or conceived illegitimately to fall into a sort of a reactionary camp, a sort of deeply, maybe problematically traditionalist camp, because those are the quarters from which lots of criticisms of modernity issue. But this is not just an unfortunate and an unfair circumstance. It's also fundamentally distortionary about how modernity itself emerged and certain traditions which antedate and then it perhaps grow on, albeit in the margins with modernity. So much by way of some introductory remarks. I guess I could turn it over to you, WD. I don't know if you want to say anything else by way of introducing yourself, or if you just want to maybe start by situating the notion of modernity, especially because it's almost like an old-fashioned term now. And what I mean by that is now we're in post-modernity, where you hear a lot of that sort of chatter, the post-modern condition in which we find ourselves, and so on. And then it's post-everything, post-truth, post-irony, all the rest of it. But let's maybe just back it up a bit to modernity simply.
Sure. And first of all, thanks for having me on your show here, Tom. It's an honor and a pleasure. So this particular series of essays in egalitarian anti-modernism, and yeah, at the point we're talking here, 4 of the 10 essays have been published thus far. But as you point out, the essential goal there is to first, define what I'm meaning by anti-modernism, which requires defining what you mean by modernity, which I take a solidly philosophical approach, although then I extrapolate some political and sociological consequences that tend to flow from that as well. But the real task is, as you say, to distinguish between what I think is a discernible trend or tradition of anti-modern thought, which is egalitarian in nature, and to contrast that with what I label aristocratic anti-modernism, which might be what you allude to as the more familiar, or sometimes we're tempted to just go, well, that is what it is to be anti-modern, is this more reactionary sort of approach. And in the essays, I identify that with Joseph de Maistre and Thomas Carlyle starting out, probably, and then more 20th century sort of thinkers like Julius Evola, Ernst Jünger, and then the contemporary Alexander Dugin are all people I mention as, you know, probably falling into that aspect of anti-modern thinking. But then my task is to say that's not the whole deal, and there is a different tradition with different values and a different perspective from which modernity is critiqued, but that is less well known, I think. So just to put out there and to establish that there is this line of thought, and the people I highlight there in this, you know, we might say counter tradition would be people like William Blake and Rousseau starting out, and then people I look at later in the essay series be William Morris, G.K. Chesterton, Ivan Illich, Leo Tolstoy, and several others.
Now, one thing, that just to push it back a little bit further, even historically, because one might be tempted to infer that anti-modernism is coeval with the rise of modernism. But in fact, what you are sketching, if I'm following it correctly, precedes the emergence of modernity. And in a sense, you could say that it's part of a tension that persists through the Western tradition writ large. But one of the things that you note initially is that within a medieval context, there is a prior tension, which you highlight as crucial to what it becomes ideologically, ideationally dramatic about modernity. And that medieval controversy is the debate between nominalism and realism. And there's actually an additional point, which I will bracket for the moment, but to turn that over, you might want to flesh that out. What is nominalism versus realism? But then how that connects to the project of modernity itself.
And part of what you're talking about points to is that modernity isn't solely a chronological term or issue. It has to do with the stance one adopts. And so we can see tendencies or movements all the way back to the classical world that would contribute to modernity, or that we, looking back, could go, well, these were seeds of modern thinking all the way back to the Greek atomists or something. And as you point out, I really trace it back to tensions within the medieval context, and specifically people like Abelard and Occam, and this idea of nominalism, which simply means that when we talk about abstract concepts like human or dog, that previously people, realists, held that those concepts actually referred to something, not something material. That is, humanness isn't material. All the particular humans are material, but that there was really still something that genuinely bound all humans together, that there was a human nature and a human essence. And the thrust behind nominalism is simply to deny that, to say that these are just names, which is what the Latin means. These are just names that we give to categories or classifications for convenience sake, or for clarity's sake, or for utilitarian purposes, but that there is no essence there for behind the word human. And that really has a lot of consequences, right? If we stick with just the example of human, whether we think there is a human nature or a human essence, something that really, truly, genuinely we all have in common, something that binds us together, something shared, or whether we think that there is no such thing, plays a huge difference. And in the essay series, part of what I do is flesh out some of the political implications of that coming in the early modern period, 17th, 18th century, where people had to try to figure out, well, what is political order then, for example, if human doesn't really mean anything, if there is no shared nature, no organic connection between us, if we're really just a bunch of individuals whom we lump together intellectually for convenience sake, well, if there is no given order, if there is no given essence or purpose, well, then you have to construct it, right? And constructing order in a myriad of ways is broadly how I would see the modern project, right? So first you strip away the philosophical basis that established order to begin with, and you get a lot of freedom when you do that, right? A lot of things come open for questioning and changing and manipulating, but you lose a lot too. So whatever order and purpose there's going to be are going to become human purposes and a human order, a conceptual order, which is a difficult thing to do, but.
So now as you're speaking, a few things occur. Mm-hmm. One being that proceeding forth from the claims of nominalism and the claims of a radical nominalist, whereas obviously this tendency is deeply inspirational for the emergence of contemporary science, which I think can be admitted as a key feature of modernity. The project of science itself is ultimately in tension with radical nominalism structurally, because it is predicated on the notion that there is a nature to discover, that there is an order in the world which we can perhaps not completely, but at least partially disclose through assays, efforts, experimentation, and so forth, right? When it comes to the interrogation of the human, you see, this is what it seems that nominalism does, is it seems to abandon positionality regarding the human subject on the one hand, but on the other hand, with what does it replace that? It seems that insofar as it's yoked to science, it's replacing it with something. And I think this is maybe where the anthropology of people like Thomas Hobbes comes to bear. Does that follow, or do you want to sort of build on that or respond to that?
Yeah, so a couple things there, really. I think you're right that there is a tension between science broadly conceived and a strict nominalism. And I think really the past 100-150 years, we see various sciences moving beyond that in different ways. Where I think there is not a tension, where I think there is almost an implication, is in the technological application of science. So here I'm, you know, thinking of our ability to interact in instrumental ways with nature, in which case it's probably essential to deny natural purposes or natural schemes of organization other than causal mechanisms, which are essential. You can't have technology unless you have causation, efficient causation. So that seems to be all that you want to have left, is particular entities and their causal relationships, so that you're not impeded by a natural purpose, an ethical constraint, anything like this, right? So, you know, I'm thinking along the lines of Heidegger or someone here, who sees modern technology is a radical departure from traditional ways of interacting with the world, even when we might describe some of that as technological, the use of tools or whatever, but you see something very different going on in modern technology. And what's changed there is that whole frame, right, that you're referencing, the situation of the human, so that on a view like his, the point of modern technology is to reduce all of nature to essentially a standing reserve, right, to our purposes. What can it do for us? Standing reserve, he calls it. So while I think you're exactly right that science, understood maybe more as a pursuit of genuine knowledge, presumes more in nature than a nominalist would, but a technologist, I think, must reduce nature to something like a nominalist position in order to render it fully susceptible to our instrumental interventions. Does that?
Well, I would go further and say that the radical nominalist, insofar, and the technologist, I think, are often disposed to see nature as not simply clay to be, manipulated, but as something which is actively hostile. And I think that this is something which is really another crucial problem with modernity, is this deep hostility toward the natural world as a source of suffering, death, and so forth. Yeah. And thus, Descartes, famously calls for, lordship and mastery over nature, for the, accentuation of pleasure, diminution of pain, extension of life, perhaps even conquest of death. Similarly, Francis Bacon, right? Yeah. So this hostility redounds on the human being. Insofar as we are a component and part of nature, if we're hostile to nature itself, then it's very difficult to resist a kind of involution. And so this is something which has been noted in various ways by several people, like Jacques Ellul, for instance, in his critique of the technological. So we become subsumed as part of the technological or the technical. And you could produce other figures as well. I would just build on that and note that there's this presumption of antagonism there at the emergence of modernity.
Yeah. And in the political realm, I think Hobbes would be the shining example there, right? I mean,
everything
we want to get away from. That is the whole point of human activity, is to escape nature, to create our own world to live in with the state or Leviathan, to set the boundaries. Leviathan is essentially anti-nature, right? I mean, given what we've just said, you could summarize what Leviathan is that briefly. It is anti-nature. It's the human world of artifice as distinct from nature.
Excuse me. Apologies. Which actually provides us, the problem is this conversation could go into so many directions, because as you were saying that, it also strikes me that there's a resonance with facets of the Christian tradition, the notion of the garden or expulsion, and how this, you could get very psychoanalytic as to what's going on there. But that's a whole other ball of wax, to which we might possibly return. But in also bringing up Hobbes, you provide us a segue to a premier critic in your essay series, Rousseau, right? Mm-hmm. So for Hobbes, the movement beyond the natural, the nature, the wild, is considered fundamentally salutary. Whereas with Rousseau, the fall from nature. The fall is, in fact, seen as deeply problematic. It may be a fait accompli, but it is a kind of degeneration from a sort of pristine human essence. If you want to maybe elaborate on that difference between Rousseau and Hobbes, and then
sure.
How that relates to the to what is anti-modernism.
Yes, yeah, so I mean, in that sense, Rousseau is sort of the anti-Hobbes, although there are some ways in which they still share certain perspectives. But yeah, I mean, you know, our sort of stereotypical view of Rousseau back to nature, he presents the state of nature as a situation in which we're at one with ourselves, we're not alienated, we're not inauthentic, we're essentially happy because our relatively simple needs can easily be met. And to leave that state is something like a fortunate fall or something for Rousseau. He doesn't think that we can go back, but where we draw our inspiration from, where we draw values from, it's very much rooted in what he sees as our nature. And then it's the artificial condition of society where most of the problems arise, where we become not one with ourselves. We have who we are, but then who we project to others socially, sort of our image, so that there's inauthenticity. We introduce competition, which leads to inequalities and oppression. So he really situates the problems that we encounter as social problems, not natural problems, which is essentially the inverse image of Hobbes, right? Who sees all of the problems rooted in our natural condition or in our nature, and society is the solution that we contrive to overcome those solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short lives that we would have by nature. So in that sense, yeah, I think just the opposite. So in that sense, that Rousseau is looking back towards nature. Now, you know, he doesn't have, I think he's trying to have a more accurate anthropology than Hobbes, but you know, we would still be pretty skeptical about a Rousseauian anthropology at this point. And he's not looking back to history, really. He is still doing modern Enlightenment type thinking. About this hypothetical state of nature and a hypothetical social contract. He's still in that realm of discourse. But what's essential there is he is looking back to what's deep, what's in innate to us, what's natural to us, not what are we going to construct. And in that sense, he's, in my mind, more aligned with most pre-modern thinkers, where the basic contrast there is the pre-modern, and I would say anti-modern stance is the main job for humans is to figure out what we are, what our nature is, what good is, and then do that. Whereas, as I see it, the basic project of modernity is to figure out what do we want, and then how do we make the world do that? That's overly simplified, but I think that basic contrast is there, right? Whether it's a quest for understanding and knowledge and then figuring out how to live a human life in accordance with that, or whether it's at bottom an imposition of our will as to how to make the world accommodate our preferences and our comfort and our desires. So in that way, I also think he's structurally he's aligned with pre-modern thought in that way. And then in, you know, more mundane ways, I mean, he just prefers simpler societies. He doesn't really prefer French Parisian Enlightenment salons, even though that's where he spends his time, and maybe does prefer it, but that's not what he says he prefers in his writing. Right, in his writing, it's the natural person, the savages that are being discovered all over the world. His term, not mine. People on the edges of Europe, Poland, places like that, where he thinks Geneva, where he thinks people are still closer, more closely related to our natural form of existence in smaller, simpler societies, more virtuous and happier, ultimately, for him. You're muted.
Sorry. I do think it is important to note that the similarities between Hobbes and Rousseau are significant. Their inverse anthropologies notwithstanding. It comes down to, I mean, we talked about this a bit for the show last week, how you know, I take a rather dim view of the sort of framework which is established by the social contract with, you know, the general will and so forth, as Rousseau portrays it. Then, well, basically what he's doing is he's basically doing what Hobbes is doing, except that he decenters authority. The locus of authority is no longer vested in a singular individual. It's centered in an abstraction, general will. But that very, the very indeterminacy of the general will, I think, creates this liability to despotism, which I feel can be connected to the subsequent emergence of, you could say, the, to wax Foucauldian, the disciplinary society, the surveillance society in which we find ourselves. So I just wanted to put that note in there that Rousseau is he's a fantastic writer. You're going to have difficulty, in my view, finding someone who's more engaging and even entertaining to read than Rousseau. But his work is, I think, marked by contradictions, which I think we should be very wary. Anyway, I I don't know if you want to respond. I think maybe we're essentially on the same page, but we just have sort of different weightings of those aspects of the contradiction.
Right. Yeah. I mean, certainly Rousseau is complex in a number of ways. And there are, competing interests, competing goals, and then certainly competing interpretations of Rousseau after the fact. All sorts of things could be traced back to Rousseauian themes. I think I'm a little more sanguine about Rousseau on the general will and the social contract than you, although that's not what I focus on in the essays, because I don't think it's the best or the most interesting Rousseau. So with the exception of basically one chapter from the social contract, the chapter on civil religion, I don't really talk about the social contract in the essays.
Go ahead. Go on. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, I mean, I think tension there is to solve the problem of how we regulate our lives while remaining free, right? And he thinks the general will can do that. If a polity can discern the true, genuine general will, and then formulate laws and policies that really reflect it, then in obeying those laws, you would remain in conformity with your own interests and will, in a sense. Now, obviously, the general will is quite an abstraction. We, in politics, we have quite a history of abstractions turning into problematic realities. And I certainly wouldn't deny that the potential is there for Rousseauian ideas to lead to the opposite of what I think was his intention. But at least at a theoretical level, I think that's what he's trying to pull off, much like Kant tried with the categorical imperative, tried to pull off a way of formulating an ethics of duty, that when obeying it, we would only be obeying ourselves, and hence autonomy is preserved. It's not where I would place my emphasis on either of those tricks, so to speak. But I'm willing to grant Rousseau that's what he's trying to do is to reconcile those two things, not to surreptitiously introduce despotism or something. I don't think that's his intention. That could be the result, and I think that's probably where we agree.
Yes, and I don't necessarily think that he was fully appreciative. I don't think he was consciously trying to foster that. But I guess to try and bring it back to the root question of giving voice to the anti-modern tradition and what ultimately constitutes that kind of anti-modernity that you are advocating.
Yeah.
What is distinctively anti-modern about Rousseau? Which we've already sort of said it, but just to reiterate it in a more concentrated form.
Yeah, well, it's essentially his critique of the Enlightenment project going on contemporaneously with him, which he's actually a contributor to as well. So one more way in which Rousseau is complex, right? He's both contributing to the development of modern Enlightenment thought, but at the very same moment, he's critiquing it, right? So his buddies with the philosophes who are writing the encyclopedia and all of these things, but he's critiquing them already, right? So in from my perspective, it's kind of like you can't get much more of a jump on something than that, right? You're both creating it and critiquing it at the same time. So I would give Rousseau that honor. So in terms of critiquing the how self-sufficient reason is, right? So certainly the Enlightenment has a lot of trust and faith in the ability of reason to be employed to better our human lot. But Rousseau's critical of that from the beginning. He sees deceptions woven in with reason, and he sees reason is not a sufficient motivating power to organize a society around. So he introduces these other ideas. He gives a strong role to things like sentiment and our conscience. These aren't really modern. It's not what modernity rests on, right? This is an appeal to not something historically pre-modern, but I would say philosophically pre-modern, right? In that they're deeper than what the Enlightenment is trying to get at, and they involve a critique of the Enlightenment project. And then certainly socially and politically, right? He sees the creation of sophisticated, complex societies as inherently problematic. And whether he's exactly looking back towards pre-modern or pre-civilizational models, to some extent he is. And he's contrasting those favorably with the world being brought about through the Enlightenment. So in those senses, I would say that he is an anti-modern thinker. I do in the essay say he doesn't have either the perspective or the vocabulary to be completely consistent in that. And he doesn't seem to be fully aware of all of the philosophical assumptions that he's actually utilizing, which are largely modern assumptions. I would see him. That's how I would position him. He gets credit for launching a critique very early, but also because it's very early, he doesn't have the perspective that a 19th or 20th or 21st century thinker would have to sort of mind their P's and Q's in avoiding falling into nominalism and these sort of things.
So I think what strikes me there is the importance of conscious, right? That his position that human beings are possessed of a kind of moral intuition that is not simply outcome of relative cultural or social conditioning. And in that sense, that kind of is that what in a way connects Rousseau to pre-modern critiques or to realism? Is that the realist aspect of Rousseau that he's willing to put the cards on the table and say that human beings do have something like a sense of the moral or the ethical, which is not just pretense?
For sure. So, and ultimately traces that back to sort of the pre-moral sentiment of pity, right? Which he takes to be as deeply rooted in our nature as anything. So first, he really thinks there is a substantive human nature, and it's in that pity side that goes beyond, say, a Hobbesian or Lockean account of an atomistic individual, right? So he Rousseau admits with Hobbes and Locke that we have this innate desire and goal of self-preservation that can lead to conflict. So that's definitely Hobbes' starting point, to some extent Locke's. But equally deeply rooted is what we might call a moral sense or a proto-moral sense, which makes us want to avoid suffering amongst others of our kind, right? So there is this something built into us that forms a genuine connection between all human beings, right? So there's a more substantive view of what a human is, what human nature is, and there are at least the seeds of our being able to exist socially in a cooperative manner, because of this innate desire to avoid the suffering of others, or to, not impose unnecessary suffering on others. So I think that's part of his anti-modernism. I think, and I talk about this in the last of the essays on Rousseau, what Wiley is pretty much operating within an Enlightenment deist framework for religion and theology. He sees it as essential that we accept the existence of a divinity, and that divinity is essentially moral and will undergird our moral intuitions, because he doesn't have the faith that reason alone will either establish that truth or provide sufficient motivation for us to act according to moral norms, even if they're innate to us. So I do, and that's maybe a more controversial reading, but I do read Rousseau as having some genuine theological presuppositions that he sees as necessary to his project, and then he brings those up in the social context in On the Social Contract, as providing the necessary basis, he says, to make men love their duty. So what he's interested in there is, so he believes that duty is real. He believes that's given, that it's objective, that we really do have social obligations to one another, but that reason alone is not sufficient to get us to recognize those or to act in accordance with those moral obligations. And there are essentially two or three theological presuppositions he thinks that are useful and not contrary to reason, that need to be affirmed in order to undergird a wholesome life.
Yeah. So I just wonder, well, I was going to ask another question. One could talk about Rousseau all day because he's a thinker of sufficient breadth to demand our attention at that length. With regard to his theological suppositions, he puts them out there, but are they not rather proffered in a somewhat schematic, almost ad hoc fashion? So you have the idea of the religion or the deity existing pretty much as a placeholder, which to me is pretty unsatisfying. I'm not really interested in relying on a mere contrivance to conduce to some sort of social order. I mean, that to me drives us back to Hobbes or whatnot. But it's difficult to say. It's difficult to say.
Well, if he didn't think that the theological presuppositions were true, then that would be a proper critique. And when he's discussing in the context of a civil religion, he is explicitly talking about the political utility of these beliefs, but he talks about these other places in the Emile, for instance. And it seems to be his genuine view that for us to trust either our reason or our moral sentiments presupposes a benevolent deity. Maybe not much more than that, right? We might not need a very long list of attributes to ascribe to a divinity, but we essentially can't function and can't achieve happiness unless we trust our reason to tell us about the world and unless we trust our consciences to tell us about what's right, right? We could be skeptical about both of those points to no end. So I think he sees that as a genuine necessity. Now, whether that's, you know, just utilitarian justification of God or not, I don't. I mean, in a sense, it is because that's how he's arguing. But I get the sense that he has a genuine commitment to a deity with those basic attributes, which also is. I mean, deism is a modern notion. So in that sense, he's going along with the Enlightenment. But again, I think his reading of that is different from someone like a Voltaire or even a Locke or a Jefferson in that he seems to think for us to even have a world that makes sense presupposes something above the world that guarantees those things.
Which is really a somewhat proto-Kantian position. Because, I mean, certainly my understanding of Kant basically takes that tact with reference to the God is sort of a regulative concept. But instead of going forward, I was actually going to go backward because the structure of what we're discussing in some ways is foreshadowed millennia ago with another book, The Republic, or not just the book, The Republic, but with Plato. You talk about this as well, that in this tension here between modernism, modernity, and anti-modernism, anti-modernity is already sort of embryonic within the text of The Republic, within the discourses in ancient philosophy. I don't know if you'd like to say more about that.
Sure. Specifically, you know, in the essay I wrote on the Republic, what I was most interested there was trying to find the origin, the philosophical origin of an idea of essentially an organic society, right? Turnus Gemeinschaft or something. Where does that idea first come up? Of essentially, you know, a natural, egalitarian, harmonious social existence. And I think it can be traced back to at least Plato's Republic, specifically in the first city that he outlines there in Book Two of the Republic, which is the one we always forget about. And we worry about the second city, the Republic itself, which he describes as a feverish city. And I suggest that we should take that first, the description of that first city seriously. The character of Socrates in the dialogue says we should, says it is in fact the good society, but only when his other interlocutors insist that he have a way of bringing in luxury and some other goods does he agree to give them an account of a feverish city, which is essentially structured in order to overcome the inconveniences and the evils essentially that will be introduced by admitting those things into the city. So the first thing you need is an army. And so, you know, it goes on and on then about developing the auxiliaries and the guardian class. But my essential point there was that we should take that first description as a serious description, not a throwaway, and that we should can at least entertain the notion that Plato actually means it, because if he didn't mean it, he could have well left it out. You know, didn't need to be there for dramatic purposes, I don't think. So there's a reason it's there. And it's not inconsistent with anything in Plato that I'm aware of, that he would prefer a simple, virtuous society. Seems completely consistent with his overall thinking. Not seeing anything in Socrates that would mediate against that. Socrates isn't necessarily a fan of luxurious cosmopolitan civilization per se. So,
no, but I think the tension is that even if it's acknowledged in the Republic that the second city is a feverish one, I find it hard to escape the impression that there's at least a kind of apology for the structures which he's recommending there. I find it difficult to see the text as being merely ironical in its articulation of developing this eugenic, really quasi-meritocratic hierarchy that's gated and in which actively deceives its constituents vis-a-vis the so-called noble lie and so forth. So there, but in many ways, it anticipates the problem of modernity, in that you have how can I put it? What is the specific point of analogy, which I'm sort of intuiting here, between how things are set up there? And it actually, in a way, almost puts me in mind of the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky, where the hypocrisies are seen as necessary in order to provide stability. And yes, there is a better way, but it's so unbelievable that we can not count upon it. In fact, we almost have to presume that it is impossible and reject those who would advocate for it as themselves the true enemies of the state and thus of the people. So,
yeah, well, Plato isn't optimistic about the prospects of a republic, as he discusses in all the later books, right? I mean, he calls
I don't know. I have to go personally. I don't know. So,
and he gives a kind of how regimes decay, and I mean that's how he sees the course of human ventures, is that you know, our origin is sort of the high point, and then the natural tendency of things is to decay. So he's not completely, even in after book two of the Republic, he's not really sanguine about the prospects of either establishing or maintaining a genuinely virtuous regime. He thinks polities tend to decay, but.
I mean, I forgive me if I'm, it's been a while, right? And of course, it's certainly possible I was incorrect. I just, but again, you said Plato in any event is an ancient as opposed to a modern, right? And that is a distinction which can map on to the modern anti-modern controversy. But I don't know, that might be too complex of a thing to take on at this exact moment. But perhaps not, right? You're using Plato in the essays to indicate that there is this tradition that antedates thus, you know, it's not simply a chronological category, but also is something that pertains to certain styles of thought, which in a way show up everywhere in history, albeit in different registers.
Well, I think where that tension shows up in Plato is probably in the character of Thrasymachus, in also in the Republic, the defender of the proposition that justice just is the interest of the stronger, right? Which is a very modern idea that it's ultimately power that decides things, including what will be counted as just and unjust. I mean, that's a Hobbesian position already. And, you know, in that dialogue, Thrasymachus is representing the sophists, the rhetoricians, who Plato accuses of being more interested in persuading people than in knowing the truth, right? So already the emphasis there is on meeting human ends. What do we want to accomplish? And then how do we persuade people to follow that course of action? That's a very modern notion, I would suggest. And you know, Plato is opposing that with you know, true philosophy, the love of wisdom. But yeah, so I think at least in Greek society, that tension was already there, at least as Plato saw it, right? Those who were acting more instrumentally, those who were not seeking to conform to some sort of genuine morality, but who were seeking to serve their own interests, create the world as they wanted it to be created through the power of persuasion. I think that's a very modern notion.
So would you say that modernity or modernism or the modern is fundamentally Thrasymachean?
Yes. I mean, to the extent that's present in Plato, I think that's where that modern approach shows up most clearly in the Republic, is in the character of Thrasymachus.
I'm sort of tempted to really run with that, and the way it shows up even in now is in our deeply problematic relationship with the category of truth, right? Is there truth? And you know, now, you know, at the beginning of the conversation, I alluded to, you know, everything is postmodern, post-truth, and some of those phrases are throwaway and sort of just kind of trendy and can be dismissed, but they still sort of reflect a paradigm which has a certain cultural potency that dismisses the true as a category of fundamental naivete. In fact, when you dismiss the true as simply a kind of naivete, you basically are justifying this Thrasymachean position, which I think receives a sort of relatively explicit apology in the figure of Machiavelli, who ironically advocated for a republican form of government At least in a sense. Right. So then if it's established that the modern position is essentially Thrasymachean in character, that the true and the just are the determination of the strong, then what really is constitutive of anti-modernity is the notion that there is a truth and a justice which abides regardless of the category of the strong. Is that coherent? Do
Yes,
you
yeah, I
agree with
think
me
so.
here?
Yeah, I think so. Now, I mean, which raises a complication here if we're thinking in terms of anti-modernism, because that can't just be a return to pre-modern ways or pre-modern certainties. You don't go back, but it involves a rejection fundamentally of that modern move, right? Which can be presented, presented earlier in terms of the shift towards nominalism. We could equally well put it in these Thrasymachean terms, which, I teach a class essentially claiming that Machiavelli, Hobbes, Nietzsche, Carl Schmitt, and Foucault are in some sense the children of Thrasymachus. They're defending the guy who lost back in antiquity. So you could equally describe it that way, I think, as the move towards centralizing power that could be both human power in the form of technological control of nature, or it could be political power in terms of the control of narratives, truth, populations, right? The state. Yeah,
That
I think
being said,
that's,
so like you, sorry to interrupt, but you like raise this the you invoke Nietzsche, right? And I think that Nietzsche is anti-modern. Nietzsche is not a lover of modernity. He's a vocal and potent critic of modernity, right? So even though there are aspects which of his thought which are almost unavoidably Thrasymachean, he's not Thrasymachean in the same way as Thrasymachus. In part because I think Nietzsche retains the idea of an authentic nobility, whereas Thrasymachus is just a crass cynic. Right. The problem is that our capacity to access an authentic nobility has been vacated by the vagaries of modernity. And so now we have to come and recreate our values, which is so immense a task that the merely modern person is incapable of it. And thus the Overman, the Ubermensch is going to come. And right. So the reason I kind of want to jump on this point is because you noted that. And I think maybe Nietzsche is a useful exemplar of their position, that there are, as you say, aristocratic anti-moderns. So would you say that Nietzsche is such a figure, or am I, so what do you say to that?
Yeah, so honestly, I'm not sure whether I think Nietzsche is essentially modern or anti-modern. I do mention, actually, I think it's probably not until the 10th essay, which you won't have had a chance to read yet, that with the people I term aristocratic anti-moderns do tend to draw on Nietzsche, whether he's exactly anti-modern or not. They find inspiration there. And it's exactly the point that you're making, some authentic notion of nobility, right? Whether that's what I think is a pretty problematic conception of nobility in the genealogy of morals with the raging blonde beasts and all that can become problematic pretty darn quick. Or whether
It's weird actually when you like read it for the first time, you're like, what, where is this coming from? But so
or whether it's maybe a version that we might want to entertain more of, you know, having the strength to create oneself, to create values. In that sense, though, I think Nietzsche is still pretty modern, right? I mean, that is what modernity is about, is shaping the world and then ultimately ourselves as we will. So I'm not sure there. There are anti-modern strands in Nietzsche. He certainly rejects much of bourgeois modernity, for sure, especially the values. But for sure, people that I term aristocratic anti-moderns, thinking, you know, very strongly Ernst Jünger there would be a prime example, draw heavily on that Nietzschean creative spirit, the emphasis on will there, in responding to what they see as the corruptions or decadence of the modern world.
You know, I mean, to be fair, I don't think anybody can put Nietzsche in a box, right? He's a thinker that he's a moving target. His thought evolves, and at no point is part of the beauty and power of Nietzsche. But it was interesting that his name came up in connection with your characterization of Thrasymachean progeny. Let me ask you, this is somewhat of a non sequitur, but let me ask you this. What about Shakespeare? Do you think that Shakespeare is modern or anti-modern? Of course, it's kind of fair to sort of put it in those terms, right? But what do you think?
Right. I'm certainly not a Shakespeare scholar.
Well, I'm not a scholar either.
And then, I would gladly be.
But we're just having fun here.
But
so.
My understanding of Shakespeare, though, is that many of his presuppositions are, for example, his metaphysical presuppositions, are ones that we would associate with the pre-modern world, that he does have some conception of the great chain of being operating behind the scenes. I don't know how to prove that or point to examples in Shakespeare, and I could be wrong. I'm just going, but that's how I have heard him discussed anyway, in terms of this sort of almost Neoplatonic Renaissance framework, which, I mean, it's almost too early to go, is that modern, anti-modern, pre-modern? It's when things are shifting. I don't think we could say anti-modern, because I don't know that he would have enough conception of a modernity to have rejected it.
I would put him in the tradition that you are sketching as an egalitarian anti-modern.
Then I need to study him more.
And I mean, it shows up all over the place, but where I really think it shows up is in Hamlet. And there are passages of Hamlet, like the really like a crucial passage is the quintessence of man. Monologue, right? Look you, this sky, this brave or hanging plume, fretted with golden fire, where appeareth to me no other thing than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors. What a piece of work is a man, how noble of reason, etc., etc. But what is he but a quintessence of dust? So, like, this is a crucial passage to me, which says Shakespeare prophetically saw the issues endemic to emergent modernity and rejects them. I also think it shows up in, though I don't know his histories as well, but I think it shows up in the implicit politics of his histories, because the incredible sort of human treatment he gives to these various figures. So I mean, it was really just kind of like a softball, like, oh, let's have some fun.
Yeah.
Modern well,
you've probably convinced me I need to go reread Hamlet because I haven't read any Shakespeare in many years, and I certainly haven't read him through the lenses that I'm currently thinking in. So I will do that. You're probably right. I hope you're right. Right? It'd be nice to have Shakespeare on your side. So I hope you're
you
right.
Definitely want him on the team. So, Shakespeare's fantastic, right? Speaking of people contemporaneous, and as long as we're playing this kind of game, contemporaneous to Shakespeare, what about Milton? Milton, modern, anti-modern.
I mean, he's certainly held to be modernizing in much of his advocacy of political reform, but that doesn't necessarily settle the case. I mean, many of the Rousseau certainly was interested in political reform, as well as our Morris and G.K. Chesterton, people that I talk about later in the essay series. I think Milton is a realist, but again, we're with poets, and that's not my
forte. Yeah, I know.
But
I wasn't
I
trying
think
to like put you
Milton
on the
is
spot
a
or
realist.
so.
You can't hardly describe Satan without being a realist, because otherwise it's awfully hard to say why he's bad. So you almost have to have a pretty solid metaphysics to have a place in it that would be the lowest rung of existence. You have to have a pretty robust metaphysics to do that.
Yeah, but he's interesting, because I think you're right. I think he is ultimately a realist, and thus it maybe not strictly anti-modern, but in tension, deep tension with modernity. But his account of Lucifer is so sympathetic that it's difficult not to see him as almost wanting him to be right. And in that respect, I think there's, but maybe I don't know Milton well enough, but anyway, so.
Well,
but
certainly
to
that's
get us
what.
back on track,
Yeah,
go
well,
on.
you know, so maybe the tension's just there, right? Maybe the tension's there in the form of Satan, right? In that Milton does seem to be able to find admirable traits, right? And Satan is a rebel, and Milton's a rebel. I mean, literally, right? I mean, he's with Cromwell on the side of Parliament during the Civil War in England there. I mean, they're the rebels. He can't be unaware that it's Satan who's the rebel angel, not Michael.
But to come back to sort of like we go to move towards sort of at least a provisional resolution to this question of nobility, and we talked about this a little bit vis-a-vis Nietzsche, and he has this curious conception in some quarters, but in other quarters, understandable sort of proto-existentialist sense of nobility that shows up and is important for people like you said, Junger, maybe Evola, and some other figures as well that are sort of, as you know, the aristocratic critics of modernity.
Yeah.
But there, I think, is an other effort to recuperate the notion of the modern that shows up in someone like C.S. Lewis or G.K. Chesterton or J.R.R. Tolkien, right? For example, Lewis provides a description of the chivalric as a category which emerges from the medieval milieu as an orientation which incorporates the insights of Christianity into a world which has to struggle with its own duality, the duality within a man between urges toward violence and the imperative toward the gentle and the kind, right? So we talked a little bit about that with Michael Martin in like trying to excavate the chivalric real. I don't know if in your sort of catalog of important thinkers for egalitarian anti-modernism, you have thought much or have any in terms of any notions in terms of who or what they offer with respect to trying to create this alternative or this sort of renaissance of something like a nobility.
Sure. I agree with you on Lewis there, and I have no problem seeing him as essentially an anti-modern thinker. He's extremely critical, especially of technology and its impact on the human, as you know, the abolition of man and that hideous strength, you know, thinking of that period and that set of ideas especially, really has in to my mind one of the more profound metaphysical critiques of technology, and yeah, I would think of Lewis as a Christian humanist, essentially, right? Which is a positive project, and I would see it as running counter to the modern world. So I think that could certainly be a constructive approach to build something better out of modernity. I don't think it's the only way, for sure. But this gets back to a comment I was going to make before. Yeah, so the problem is then, what is the goal then, right? It can't really be going back to something pre-modern. That would technically be reactionary, right? So that could be, it's De Maistre's. Let's go back to monarchs. Let's forget this Republican yeah. thing, this Democratic thing, and just leave that behind us. Not usually, especially the further along in time you go, that's not going to appear to be a very realistic option to just turn the clock back. And that's not what I'm advocating. I don't think that's what any of the folks I talk about in the essay are talking about. But, you know, it is a real problem, right? Because you can't just act like the modern world didn't happen, right? And we have the problems around truth, around power, that we have for reasons, and they don't just go away when you go, well, I'm just rejecting modernity. Well, those were still real problems. We're still kind of hung up on those. We need some answers to those, and the answers don't come prepackaged. When you say, well, I'm anti-modern, that means these things all go away. You don't have to be nominalist anymore. How you recover, you know, philosophically, how you recover a realist metaphysics is not an easy task, right? That you identify that or something like it as the goal is helpful, and might point you in a constructive direction. But, you know, whatever comes out the other side of modernity for an anti-modern is not going to be the same as the pre-modern world, right? It might carry forth some values that were archaeologically dug up and brought forward as valuable, precious things. But it'll be, how do we find new ways? And that's what, to some extent, I hear you suggesting Nietzsche might have been doing, at least in terms of genuinely noble values. What might that look like if we reject bourgeois liberal 19th century modernity? How might those reappear in the world? Nietzsche is not going to be my the person I'm most following for constructive advice. That's, you know, maybe kind of a personal thing. I'm not
nor
I Nietzsche
nor
a lot,
me,
especially as a diagnostician, prescriber, I think it's awfully easy to go wrong with Nietzsche. But yeah, so that's an open question, and I don't have a cookie cutter answer, right? It'll be a human creative project, and we will have to find. I think if we're going to have a good future, it's going to involve finding a way to reestablish and relive some of these more fundamental human values, right? Discovering again that there is a human nature, right? And any view of that's going to have to take account of Darwin, right? Which, at least from many readings, the whole point is to get rid of the idea of any sort of fixed species natures there. So it's not going to be an unproblematic project. But, you know, it seems still the big move is to admit that the modern move was largely a mistake, or at least had very tragic consequences. And that doesn't really make you postmodern in the sense that you mentioned earlier, which really I just see as, you know, along with people like Frederick Jameson, I think really just see that as modernity living itself out until through entropy it becomes nothing or something. So that's not what I'm, you know, it would be technically postmodern situation, but not what we mean by postmodern. But yeah, what exactly that looks like, who knows? I mean, Lewis is creative in thinking along those lines. I think G.K. Chesterton's creative in thinking along those lines. You know, Morris has a sort of almost medieval socialism that he wants to put out there. And whether we really get a chance to just construct this to our liking is probably unlikely, because the world's not going to sit still while we set about settling all these questions and creating whatever vision of the world it is that we come up with. More likely, you know, personally, I think our world's in quite a bit of trouble, and I think it's quite unstable. So I think really the next probably century will be a whole lot of reacting to whatever instabilities and opportunities that instability throws at us. And if we can bring some genuine, tested, humane values to our responding to that, I'd be pretty happy with that. You're more likely to get a good world out the other end than if you don't have access to those values.
Well, I concur. And really, we just scratched the surface here, because you know, we never even, for instance, brought up the question of class, you know, the importance of Marx historically and conceptually Marxism, or the socialist project altogether, the revolutionary tradition. We haven't even really touched that stuff, I mean, except implicitly, right? So we'll have to sort of follow up with more than that. But the issue of humane value and the importance of recovering a realist metaphysics is, in my view, intimately linked to realizing something like moral energy again. I think that we live in a climate of remarkable despondency, because the idea of being, you know, they say God is dead, but perhaps it's almost more accurate to say that morality is dead. Yeah. And how do we recover a sense of a real energetic relationship with something like justice,
yes,
or kindness or truth,
yeah.
Yeah, without just treating it as an ad hoc convention. And that's why realism is important, because it says it's not just an ad hoc convention.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, the irony is that the first thing that dies after God dies is mankind, right? What are we? Right. If there isn't a human nature, what are we? Well, we're whatever we want to be, I guess. But as Lewis pointed out, what that means in practice is we are whatever those with power condition us to be. Right. And if they don't have humane values, it's all gone. So So it's, you know, if you work backwards, you need some sort of metaphysical basis to get to the ethical, I think. I completely agree with you.
Well, maybe that's a nice sort of point to sort of adjourn. And we can maybe do another one as more of your essays come out, because you only four of
Oh,
you
that would be great.
published as of a time, and so on. So, you know, get this up probably tomorrow, and I'll send you the links and all that stuff. Is there anything else you would like to say before we sign off for the evening?
No, just thank you again for taking the time to do this. Glad you came across the Dr. Sam video. That was a very fortunate thing. Good folks, you and her husband out there in New Zealand. It's gotten a lot of people to check out the essays, which I appreciate. Again, I'd point people to winteroak.org.uk to see those and a lot of other great stuff. And then my Substack, Philosopher's Holler, basically the essays are published simultaneously, roughly on both places.
Lock and roll. So, and I need to reach out to Paul, is Sudenick or Kudinick?
Kudnik, yeah, Kudnik.
Paul Kudin, at White Oak, you know. So, being also an anarchist. Sorry. Anyway, we'll wrap it there for the night. Thank you again, WD, and I'll talk to you guys soon.
Thank you, Tom.
So, all right. Ciao. Do-do-do.